He will not get to witness the NBA Finals in his backyard. He was there for Game 6 of the West Finals. A lot has happened the last week in college football, we'll discuss. You can catch his work for USA Today online, usatoday.com, on Twitter. Use the handle at George Schroeder. George, thanks for the time as always. How you doing?
Man, I am great. Currently standing outside the hotel at Sandestin in Destin, Florida, where the Southeastern Conference is having its annual meetings. And tomorrow I'm going to Irving, Texas to catch yet another round as the Big 12 turns. So a little bit of a whirlwind this week.
As the Big 12 turns, I like that. Speaking of, you wrote a story today that posted Texas A&M entering year 5 under Kevin Sumlin. They had the great opening year, 11 wins, 9-8. Last season after October, they only beat Vandy in Western Carolina. George, if I'm getting the gist right, this is not a guy who's kidding himself. He gets the pressure has elevated, and he really needs to reverse the course of his program, doesn't he?
Well, he does. I don't think he wants to admit that. I mean, he basically would play it off as though, hey, there's always pressure here. But, look, there's no question that Kevin Sumlin is on the hot seat. In fact, some people might say he is on the hottest seat in the Southeastern Conference, which, you know, on the one hand, it seems crazy because his tenure is the best period for Texas A&M football over a you know, 4 or 5 year run in the last, you know, 20, 25 years, and for at least in a 5 year, you know, lump.
Right.
But, you know, after they went 11-2 in year one, 2012, he, you know, I think the Aggies thought they were about to blow through the SEC West. And let's be honest, they weren't. They had been struggling most years in the Big 12 back in the, when it was the old Big 12 South. They had not been competitive. And so the idea that you're going to move to the SEC West and suddenly be competitive doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, Johnny football happened. They went 11-2. They beat Alabama in that big-time game in Tuscaloosa. And the next thing you know, they're blowing up their stadium and rebuilding it to be the largest stadium in the SEC and the fifth largest in the country, 102,000-something. And, you know, all of this, and it's a Taj Mahal. I mean, it's almost $500 million. You know, all of a sudden the pressure and the expectations have skyrocketed through the roof, and they have sort of slid back in each of the next three seasons. And so season number 5 is a really big one for Kevin Sumlin.
Now, for the optimists, they made some notable moves. Noel Mazzoni will run the offense. He was here in the Pac-12 at UCLA 4 years, and ironically, they opened with UCLA.
Yeah, and Arizona State before that. A veteran offensive guy that with a lot of credibility.
And they also now, despite some of the missteps and the transfers, they did bring in a veteran quarterback. And from what you wrote, I guess the players maybe have taken a role upon themselves to kind of unite this team, put some of the negativity behind them, and move forward.
Well, that's what they're saying. And I don't doubt that they're trying to do that either. But one of the things about stories that you write in the offseason is that they kind of go a couple different ways, but if there's been a disappointing season the year before, then the sort of the universal story of every school's offseason or every team's offseason is how much closer we are and how much harder we're working and more consistent we're paying attention to the little details and blah, blah, blah. And I don't doubt that that's the case, and I also don't doubt that that's the formula for being a better team the next year. Obviously, you got to have talent and things like that, but dedication is a huge piece of this. And I also don't doubt that some years you have fewer players that exhibit the right amount of dedication and focus, and some of that may have hit A&M. But I say that to say, I hear that a lot when you go around the country. That's sort of the same piece that you hear every time. It's a story about, you know, last year wasn't as good as we wanted it to be, but we're going to make it better this year. So, do I think that they mean it? Yeah. Do I think it's the truth? I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
So are you saying that teams also, after letter of intent recruiting day, filled holes, addressed needs, and are optimistic about next season as well?
I've never had a coach come out yet, and you haven't either, and say, you know, we really missed on the 6 best kids I'm not sure that we're athletic enough, and we certainly we needed quarterbacks. We didn't get any, so it's really not a very good recruiting class. No coach has ever said that. They've always met every need, as you said. They're always gotten more athletic. They really like the bunch's character, and they felt like, you know, they're across the board at every position going to get better.
Brilliant. Let's stay in the SEC. We're talking about Ole Miss and Hugh Freeze yesterday. You know, his line about we made mistakes but didn't cheat. I almost felt a little Richard Nixon. I take responsibility but not the blame. The 9 violations under his watch, 4 are level 1. You think he's splitting hairs and or maybe should have worded things differently, or does any of what he says hold water?
Well, sure. And before we get into that, I would say probably for the average listener, a level 1, if you're familiar at all with NCAA violations, there used to be major violations and secondary violations,
right,
is how they classified. They've now changed that, and there's a 4-tiered level 1, 2, 3, and 4. Whereas 3 and 4, and really 2, 3, and 4, are really sort of the, what used to be the old secondary, not quite as big a deal, minor and inadvertent violations. And level 1 is the big boys, the majors. So when you say they had 4 level 1s on his watch, you know, that's a bad deal.
Right.
But he's definitely sticking to the party line. I mean, so what they will tell you is 3 of them had to do with Laramie Tunsil, the offensive tackle who, you know, just went in the draft famously. And 3 of those level 1s had to do with him and were all adjudicated last year and all had to do with him and or family members and didn't have anything to do with staffing, and they didn't know about it till later. Then they would also say that only 1 had to do with a staff member, and that they disagree with the NCAA investigators, who are sort of the prosecuting attorneys in this structure, who are charging them with a level 1, and they think it's a level 2 or a level 3, and that's what they're going to try to argue to the Committee on Infractions. So, you know, if, in fact, all of that makes it sound like, okay, I can explain away all 4 of those things. Now, I don't completely buy those explanations, and I'll say one other thing. The Laramie Tunsil stuff from the draft, remember when we all watched the first, there was the him taking the hit from the bong with the gas mask on.
Right.
That's not an NCAA issue. But then remember later in the evening, somebody released text messages, screenshots of text messages on his Instagram account. And then he admitted that, yes, he had taken money from coaches. Those text messages were between him and the director of football ops about a payment, getting some money for his mom's rent and electric bills and things like that. And he admitted later that evening to reporters that he had taken money. That stuff's not in any of this.
Wow. That's
the NCAA is going after right now. Now, I don't know, and I'm not optimistic the NCAA is going to get it, because I'm not sure Laramie Tunsil is going to cooperate. He has no reason to cooperate with the NCAA. But if, in fact, there are other text messages like that, then, you know, this could get a lot worse for Ole Miss before it gets any better.
Let's get to Baylor. Talk about timing. Last week, we wondered about the future of Art Briles. We didn't realize we'd find out the next day. Then the AD steps down, and today, Ken Starr, the president, resigns. Obviously, the allegations, though, the charges are despicable. Any sense to, you know, flip a coin? What could be next? Criminal charges, NCAA sanctions, or will they try to push that? Look, we've made 3 high-profile changes. 3 guys lost their jobs, and we're moving forward, and that should be enough.
Well, first of all, you know, Ken Starr had been removed from his president position the same day that Art Briles was fired, but he had been shunted over to chancellor, which is a nothing position, but it's a big title, and so he's resigned that, and he's a tenured law professor at the school. That was the news that in the move yesterday or today, they'd already fired him essentially as president. So I don't believe there'll be criminal charges. I think the Title IX investigation from the Department of Education may cause some issues for Baylor, and maybe should, but I don't know how that affects football. When it comes to, and I don't think it will, when it comes to NCAA, I think they're going to be, you're going to hear people suggest that. You're going to hear people talking about the possibilities. After Penn State and the NCAA's massive overreach in that situation, and then their subsequent complete reversal a couple of years later and how they pulled back and got rid of all the sanctions, basically, that they'd slapped on them, I think they'll be really loath to even begin to get into this. Frankly, it's not an NCAA purview situation. Now, if, in fact, there are NCAA, say, recruiting violations or other sort of traditional NCAA rule violations that somehow get uncovered in this, and I haven't heard of anything like that, then,
right.
Yeah, I think the NCAA would slap them pretty hard. But I haven't heard of anything like that being uncovered. No one would be surprised in a situation that was being run like that to find that stuff, but I haven't heard of it being uncovered. So NCAA-wise, I don't see anything hurting the football program. What's going to hurt the football program is what's already happened. You know, the coach getting fired. I think some other staffers will end up being fired as well, and the assistant coaches will all turn over. You know, the seven guys that were signed from their recruiting class in February chose not to enroll. This is the week everybody shows up on campus and enrolls, and they're going to go elsewhere. There may be more that bail, too. So basically they face the decimation of that class, the ones they signed. And then with an interim coach, Jim Grobe, and this sort of staff, whoever ends up being on the staff this year, it's all interim status. You don't know what's going to happen.
Sure.
How are you going to recruit for next February? So, I mean, I think they face the loss of consecutive recruiting classes. We're talking football, and anytime we talk about this, we should say talking football and impact on football pales in comparison
Sure.
to what happened on the campus and the reasons we're having to talk about this.
No, that's great information as we continue with George Schroeder, USA Today. I love the back and forth between Nick Saban and Jim Harbaugh. Saban kind of insinuates these satellite camp activities might happen outside the rules. And, of course, Harbaugh's kind of pulls the, well, didn't the Crimson Tide break the rules and now you're going to lecture us? Is this anything more than just off-season gamesmanship and ego stroking, or is there any water to what either guy is saying?
Well, first of all, I'm on the side that if you think there's a problem with satellite camps, there's a simple solution. It's you don't have to do satellite camps.
Right.
And, you know, for the SEC to continue to whine and complain about this is just a joke, frankly. That said, satellite camps, as they've been done by Pac-12 coaches and by the Oklahoma States of the world, which was pretty low-key, send a couple coaches down, do some camps, you get your name out there, you do some good things with the high schools in the area, and wasn't a big deal. That's different than what Jim Harbaugh is doing. And, you know, of course, obviously he fired up the SEC coaches, and he continues to do that. And, 38 camps in the next month or whatever it is, that's just, craziness, frankly, that those guys, and it's all about pushing the Michigan brand. And, yeah, it's about recruiting. There's no question about that. Now, again, if you don't like it, just don't do it. That's my point. And if you do want to do that, that's fine. But let me just say one thing. Nick Saban didn't take any shots. I was in the room yesterday. Didn't take any shots at Jim Harbaugh. Somebody asked him a specific question about Jim Harbaugh and, why is it wrong for Jim Harbaugh to do it or to like to do it? Because he had been talking about why he didn't like satellite camps. Nick had been. And so he said, look, I'm not talking about Jim Harbaugh. Whatever Jim wants to do is fine. I don't have any problem with Jim Harbaugh. He said, I just don't think this is good for college football or in the best interest of college football or something to that effect.
Right.
And somehow that got translated to Jim Harbaugh as Nick Saban took a big shot at you. And then Jim Harbaugh, in typical fashion, went way over the top. Now, his point is valid. Nick Saban had been lecturing about how they're going to have compliance issues and recruiting violations and things like that happen at these satellite camps. And Jim's correct in that Alabama just fired its defensive line coach for recruiting violations, and maybe they don't have a stature to talk about it. About whether people are going to have to break rules at satellite camps. But, frankly, Jim Harbaugh is fun for you and me. I think it'd be nice if he dialed it back a little bit.
Well, I'm on the same page. I'm actually to the point now where I'm like, man, this guy is starting to just flat annoy me. I want to wrap with the NBA. They were up 3-1. You were at OKC for game 6, and of course now they've gone on to become the first team in 35 years to blow a 3-1 lead in the conference finals. I mean, the finish of game 6 in particular, I mean, as sloppy, is that kind of like the definitive, if you're going to say good OKC, bad OKC, that was the potential implosion you see with them sometime?
Yeah, they lost fourth quarter leads all year long, and over the course of the Durant-Westbrook era, they've been known for sort of hero ball down the stretch sometimes. It's Sometimes they get away with it because they're so good, and sometimes they don't. But largely over the last 8 weeks or so even, it's been a really rapid transformation. They transformed into a completely different team mentally and structurally and sort of tactically, and had become, you know, very formidable. I thought for large stretches of that series they were the better team, frankly. Now, that's not to say that those aren't luck shots. Those guys can flat-out shoot from Golden State. They're fantastic and fantastic fun to watch. But here's Oklahoma City in position and not quite in control, but, you know, in really pretty good shape with about 3 minutes left in the Game 6 to close out the series. And you're right, it's just an implosion. They fumbled the ball away, and the part of the reason that they had six turnovers in their last eight possessions partly is because they were playing hero ball all of a sudden. You're like, what happened there? And you have to think that it was just sort of a mental lapse and not having sort of the wherewithal and the maturity to handle the position they were in. Meanwhile, Golden State took full advantage, and then when they had that same chance to blow it in Game 7, you know, they struggled real briefly, and Durant scored the seven straight points, but they closed it out. And I think that's the difference in the maturity level of those two teams. There's not much difference. I mean, they do things differently, but there's not much difference at all in the talent level of the two teams. The maturity level is different.
Do you have a preference? I mean, Cleveland could break a 50-plus year major title drought, or Golden State off the magical regular season going back-to-back. Do you have a preference, or like a lot of neutral fans, just would it be awesome to see like a cutthroat seven-game series?
I want Stephen Curry to score 70 points a game. And look, Klay Thompson went all Steph Curry for about a game and a half there in game 6 and 7. I want Steph Curry to score all the time in all those crazy, wacky shots that he gets off and Golden State to win it. If it goes 7, I guess I'm okay with that, but if I were going to pick a team to cheer for, that's the one.
All right. Cool. You're on record officially, George. As always, USAtoday.com, on Twitter at George Schroeder. Always look forward to our Wednesday chats. You travel safe, and give everybody our regards in Big 12 country.
All right, man. Thank you.
Take it easy.